Hi, this is Paul. I wanted to make a video on what I'm calling the hidden dynamics beneath the Protestant same-sex marriage debates that make it so difficult. Now, I've received a lot of good feedback and some pushback from the video that I released earlier this week, Why Marriage Equality Means the Death of Protestant Churches. A number of you didn't like the term marriage equality. I'm going to explain why I chose that term. A lot of people sort of passed over the Protestant part of this, and it's not a small piece of that title. In fact, it's a very integral piece of that title, all of which I can't go into in this video, but I wanted to walk through some of the things that I've been thinking about. I've been doing more writing on CRC Voices, trying to process this, and on CRC Voices, which is a little listserv. It's an excellent small community where people who've known each other for a long time and trust each other and love each other, well, we do fight, but we keep listening to each other, I think, at least for the most part. I mean, I at least listen to both sides. I try. So I think beneath this debate, there are a lot of important things to learn. But this, of course, is the big fight right now that will, I believe, likely rip up my particular denomination in fairly short order. The Reformed Church of America is currently coming apart at the seams. There are deep cultural structural reasons why this fight is so devastating in Protestant Christian churches. Now, the first thing we have to get beyond is what I call the binary shibboleth filter. What do I mean by that? This is nearly universal in all of us, and it's because of combinatorial explosion that the world is so complex we can't process it. So what we do is we have within us all of these little filters that we use to decide how to respond instinctively, immediately to things that come at us. Before I've used, I don't remember, it's, you know, is it the pineal gland? I don't remember. It's this. It's a little part of the brain, basically, that is before your conscious self. That I always remember the time when I was in junior high and, you know, a ball came whizzing towards me I didn't see and it clocked me. Well, I was always pretty good at dodgeball. And, well, what do you use in dodgeball? You don't sit there and think about the trajectory of the ball in dodgeball. You just move. And we have this built into us, not only in terms of projectiles that physically come at us, but we have it in terms of all kinds of issues. And so even just making the thumbnail, just by virtue of the thumbnail, oh, Vander Clay is on this side or that side of this issue or that issue. So subscribe, don't subscribe, listen, don't listen. We all do this. We have to do this. The world is too large. But if you really want to learn something, you're going to have to learn to resist the impulse. You know, I've been talking, you know, vaccines have been going around, and I keep telling people, it's amazing that we allow total strangers to inject us with substances that we don't know anything about all the time. And so we dress people up in lab coats, and we call them doctors, and we give them credentials, and we do all of this social building in order to afford for us to do what instinctively our body says run. And, you know, you see this when you bring your little kid into the doctor, and they come at the kid with a needle, and, of course, the kid looks then at the parent like, are you going to let them do this to me? Yes. So you got to get beyond this filter. If you don't get the beyond, and again, you need the filter. It's a good thing. We all need it for a variety of things. But for many issues like this, you got to get beyond the filter and try and look at things. And your position on the issue might not change at all. But there is gold underneath the ground to find, to figure out, okay, what can I learn? Let's not waste the conflict. Let's learn more about a whole bunch of things, because usually when you get a conflict this big, there are deep, deep things under the surface that impact so much more of our lives. So get beyond the binary shibboleth filter. Now, shibboleth, you can look it up on Wikipedia. It comes from the Old Testament. If you don't know about it, read about it. It's an interesting thing. Nearly universal human beings, psychotechnology to manage combinatorial explosiveness. We see or hear one thing and we decide instantly whether or not we will spend any more time on it. It's often accompanied by a visceral emotional reaction of anger or disgust or vexation. Many people on both sides of this basically shut down immediately and just go into defense mode because of it. And that's, again, it's normal and natural. It's how people operate in groups. But these big conflicts are revelatory. There are often myriads of other issues hidden within that a fight like this can bring to the surface. And if you can resist the instant binary shibboleth filter response, you can usually find real learning underneath. Now, there are two issues, there's way more than two, but usually the way the discussion is pursued in places like the Christian Reformed Church, there are two things that are often sort of intertwined, and the difference between beneath them is missed. One is merciful accommodation. That's a posture. And there have been, you know, beautiful speeches given in synod, basically saying same-sex attracted individuals have this experience through no fault of their own. For many people, it's enormously durable to ask them to not find partnership or permanence or marriage is inhuman, unchristian, unthinkable. And for many people, that merciful response is a very persuasive thing. And to say, well, let's find some accommodation that will at least, you know, not have them suffer so. So that's the first. The second is the equality justice assertion. And whereas the first one comes and appeals to our mercy, the second one comes and appeals, well, in some ways, to our sense of justice, which, as I mentioned in a previous video, is a very powerful, it's a very powerful spirit. Same-sex attraction is a normal human variant and should not be considered to be pathological. And so the demand is equality. And so the argument usually starts asking for mercy, and usually stories are forefronted, stories of suffering, and gosh, if you have any kind of Christian sympathy at all, why don't you figure out what can be done to alleviate this? But very quickly, justice rolls in and say, no, this is a case of justice. It must be done. And subtly what has happened is the experience of suffering on one party, which is now said to be, well, maybe it's justifiable, but let's make accommodation. Now, who suffers is the other side. In fact, you who are standing in the way, you must suffer so that justice can be done. And in many ways, it's sort of a pivot of the request of who's suffering. If you pay attention, many fights are like this. It's not about just simply alleviating suffering, because you will say, well, what about the part of the church that believes this is wrong? Well, they deserve their suffering. They can change it by changing their mind, which is just the flip side of the old traditional orientation argument. Well, they're same-sex attracted. They're choosing to be this way. They should just change their mind. Well, there's a durability on both sides in this argument. So in many ways, this fight is not about who's right and who's wrong. This fight is about who's going to suffer. So the justice equality assertion really takes on momentum fast and leads to all sorts of things like I described in the other video. Very quickly now, people in your denomination that, you know, one day it was illegal, the next day it was not. Suddenly, anybody who even has internal private reservations about the legality or morality of this, they now are not simply, they're no longer, their mercy is no longer a consideration. Now they're simply unjust. Now they're simply wrong. And now they must be somehow re-educated, or one way or another, they must be shown the light and forced to change their mind, because we cannot allow this violation of justice to continue even inside their brains. Well, maybe they can have it in their brains, but they can't open their mouths. And I think most of us have a sense for how very quickly sort of this demand for equality and justice goes from being a plea to a demand, to an insistence, and in some cases, in some venues, can even become tyrannical. And people are seeing this. Now, a very helpful book on this, which has been around a while now, is Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind. And basically what he shows is, in some ways, analogous, even though I'm not drawing an equivalent and saying that same-sex attraction and orientation is is less durable or even as durable as people's positions on it. I think for many people to change a position, which is for the most part theoretical, is far easier than durable same-sex attraction in many people. The question here is that these positions are pre-rational. People didn't choose their position on these things. It was part of the first draft that was imprinted upon them. And yeah, people can be educated out of it. But for the most part, what usually happens is that you just keep educating the youth, and the old people who had the idea die off. And in many ways, ideas about racism sort of followed that path in the United States. The more and more pressure there was socially, the more and more racists went in the closet, and the more and more, well, that sort of wins. But the key here is that this stuff is pre-rational. And we tend to think that the ideas of morality that we have are somehow arrived at through some rational means. And again, this is all about status in our culture, because rationality has status and inherited authority has far little. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. And Jonathan Haidt has all these delightful ways of demonstrating this in his book. These are not rational justifications. And you can find these videos on the internet where Jonathan Haidt and his little students who are doing his studies for him will ask people, you know, questions about things like sex with siblings. And again, I'm not making a comparison here about same-sex attraction and sex with siblings. I'm making the point that for many people, sex with siblings is a taboo. But if you ask them to rationally justify it, well, you use birth control, or maybe the siblings are same-sex and so it won't be a problem. So what's wrong with it? People almost always jump to harm, but if you can say, well, what is the harm really? Well, still they doggedly cling to their idea. And he has other crazy examples to just demonstrate. There's a lot of post hoc rationalization going on with many, many of our moral instincts. And obviously the whole book is about that. So, you know, I got a fair amount of pushback on Voices and YouTube comments about various directions of this. And I'm not surprised, because anytime you weigh into an issue like this, you have the binary shibboleth filter that you're dealing with. And so people, they'll just see the thumbnail and boom, the comments start to fly. And, you know, when I make a video like this, I understand the game. Part of having a career in a church is you live through these fights for decades, and they're not going away. The women in church office fight isn't going away. It's the nature of this sort of thing. And so many of the conservatives will just simply say, well, same-sex acts are inherently sinful. That's the position. Accommodating sin is not pastoral care, it's negligence. And it's either nested in a natural law argument, or it's an afterlife judgment argument. And I'm not denying any of these things. I'm just stating them and putting them on the table as such, so at least we know what we're talking about, okay? And again, the binary shibboleth filter will grab onto these things, and you're going to say yes and no, yes and no, yes and no. And that's fine. And again, hold that filter off and continue to dig a little bit deeper, because I'm not saying you're going to change your position on any of these things. I'm just saying there are more dynamics under the surface that help shine light on not just this conflict, but lots of conflicts. Now, the established position of the Christian Reformed Church of North America is exactly this, that same-sex acts are inherently sinful, and accommodating sin is not pastoral care, but negligence. And again, as I talked about the Human Sexuality Report, these things in many ways are built into the report. And I know that for some of you, this triggers you. You can't go any further. I get that. And I'm not trying to change your mind on this. I'm just saying, take that little bit of data and put it over here and leave it there. And those of you who are saying, why isn't the pastor arguing for these points? I get that too. I'm just saying, take this data and put it over there. Okay, there's other things I want to talk about. I know some of you are over here, and I know some of you over there. I want to talk to both of us. Okay, it's both of us inside. What's interesting about this is All One Body, which again is this group in the Christian Reformed Church that is now putting out videos trying to move the needle on what Synod does on the Human Sexuality Report. They don't take this thing on directly. Now, I don't know that anybody's thought through the argumentation that I've just given. I think they know this implicitly just by watching that the arguments up front don't sway people. They don't move the needle. And so what you'll tend to hear are stories. And now the other side plays this game. I remember when Rosaria Butterfield came out with her book, which people found devastating. Because here was a woman, she was an English professor in a public university, or at least in a university with a lesbian lover, a lesbian mate, and she becomes a Christian and she gives up her gay lifestyle and she marries a man and she goes on the road talking about her idea. And if she was some kind of brutal ideologue, and we can point to many, you can name many of those who the other side doesn't like, and maybe the other side thinks are their champions. Rosaria Butterfield was a very compelling speaker. And I remember when her book came out, Rachel Held Evans was like, that's just one story, that's just one story. The world is made up of stories, and that's part of this too. Because as a pastor, you're around long enough, you know a lot of stories. And stories, you might have more stories on one side than another side, but they don't really sort of weigh out like stones or something like that. You have to work through these things. Now, actually, this issue reignites a long-standing crisis in Protestantism. And I know I just triggered a whole bunch of Roman Catholics and Orthodox to say, see, sola scriptura. Your confessions, it's confessions. What you need to do is trust the hierarchy of the church. Okay, but I've been around most of you enough to know y'all got your own issues with your apostolic succession and your hierarchies too. Okay, so all I'm just doing is I'm not going to confess your sins and shortcomings. I'll confess our own. In many ways, part of the reason why this is a Protestant fight is because of the way Protestant churches are structured, what they intend to do. Orthodox and Roman Catholic churches are quite different. Of course, Anglicans are sort of halfway in between on many of these issues. But basically, this is a deep crisis in confessionalism. And whereas the women in church office fight in the Christian Reformed Church very early on, many in both sides could agree it's not a confessional issue. Once that justice thing took over, though, it sort of triggers the fact that we now have other ways of discerning that confessions don't cover. And part of how we're seeing this is in the Christian Reformed Church, you have Safe Church stuff. You have the Christian Reformed Church. I made this point in the 3-hour video. On one hand, they're sort of a loosening, and on the other hand, they're sort of a tightening. And these things are kind of going together. So another thing that Synod is working on is a code of conduct, because people are saying, well, in my workplace, I have code of conduct. Why don't we have ministerial code of conduct? So a church that's interested in recruiting me recently sent me a bunch of their materials, and in it was their code of conduct. And it's just interesting because the confessional issues, for the most part, aren't really, the confessions have ossified. Confessionalism has ossified. And you're quite unlikely to get kicked out of the Christian Reformed Church for violating any of these confessional issues. You're far more likely to get kicked out of the Christian Reformed Church for violating things that aren't anywhere near these confessions, but are either moral codes or implicit codes of conduct. And that's why there's sort of a different implicit confessionalism that is sort of going alongside. But then if you look at both systems, you say, well, which one is really operating? Well, it's fairly easy, because you can say which one are getting people formally disciplined in the church, which ones are getting people fired. There are your confessions. Now, they might say, well, they might not be headspace things. Yeah, but those boundaries in human beings go fast because, again, at one point, you know, one day it was okay to think this about a certain group of people, and the next day now you're unjust. And, well, we don't really have a justice list as such in any of our confessions, but, and this is what you see with some of the Protestant split-off groups, because whenever you have a split-off, then you write a new confession. And so right now in the area of human sexuality, there's a lot of people writing confessions about the issues that we're fighting over now. And if you read the Heidelberg Catechism, the Belgian Confession, and the Canons of Dort, you will find treatments of the issues that the church was fighting over when these documents were written. And so there's a deep struggle in Protestantism about these kinds of things. And do you keep writing new confessions? What do you do with the old? How do you really manage time? The bigger difficulty is that in many ways, the theology and the recalibrating and the grooming and the construction of people, all the theology is being done on TV and movies and music, and it's far more broad and impactful than a lot of the stuff that is, everybody keeps talking about old dead white men. Well, not a lot of people read those books anymore. You know, maybe the pastors, maybe some of the nerds, and some denominations are nerdier than others, but a lot of the people in the pews, and if you have a Protestantism where basically the way in which democracy sort of came into the public sphere was through the church, people vote. And so if you go to the All One website and you click on the resource tab and you look on the books tab, here are books that I very much would expect to find. And some of them I've read, some of them I hadn't. But for the most part, I think most of these books sort of help people who are intuitively already leaning one way begin to say, okay, these are the reasons why what I've sort of pre-consciously figured out was right is right. Now, this is a very dangerous argument, and I've talked a lot about two-level theories, and so... But this is the way that people work, and we have to wrestle with it. So people implicitly looking for justification, validation for what they are already feeling inside. And there are plenty of books on the other side, too. I mentioned Rosaria Butterfield. Deep crisis for Protestantism and sola scriptura, because ideally in a Protestant church, the Bible should determine this. And, well, all of these people are just fighting over what the Bible does and doesn't say. Part of the difficulty about this issue is, unlike, let's say, the women in office issue, where you could point to Deborah and Lydia and Junia, there just really aren't any examples in the Bible. And so the, you know, a lot of more literalistic Protestants just basically look at these books and say, you're getting too far afield from the plain reading of the text. But to be fair to the other side, plain reading of the text is almost always culturally conditioned in one way or another. And yeah, I know you Orthodox and Roman Catholics are going to be saying, points for us, points for us. Yeah, points for you, but, you know, I've got plenty of points for us too. Worldview persuasion is far more subtle, and I almost always point to this video that you can find. Veritas always defends their copyright on this video on YouTube, so I usually don't play much of it, but I'll put the link below. Dallas World, the nature and necessity of worldview. And he talks about, you know, walking with a young evangelical student on, let's say, the University of Southern California, where he taught, and the young student might make a dismissive statement about evolution, and just watch everybody's eyes. There's a binary shibboleth filter. Moral persuasion is usually done by implicit communal status pressure. It's sort of the persuasion of eye rolls or the persuasion of the cool kids. And in one of my videos I mentioned, I think it was Young Life that had their evangelism project of you know, going into the public high schools and looking for the cool kids and sending your missionaries to work hard on them, because you know that if the cool kids are starting to find Jesus cool, lots of other kids will follow. We're like that. And worldview often is sort of calibrated and formed by these kinds of pressures. Now, Hollywood has been majoring in this kind of thing for years, of course. And depending on what issue and which side, you might cheer or you might cringe. You know, I watched Tombstone the other day, which is a really delightful movie in many ways. But, you know, when the beautiful actor dies and that one cowboy, you know, gives up the cowboys because how could they kill someone so beautiful? It's like a little subtext going on there. Didn't want to write anything too explicit for the 19th century. Might break the fourth wall a little bit. And many things since then, Will and Grace, I mean, there's plenty of stuff written on the internet basically about how marriage equality was able to sweep through so quickly, and lots of people have diagnosed this thing, and you can go and read about it. But of course, you know, on the bridge of the Starship Enterprise, Kirk, you know, Uhura, here's a black woman, and during the late 60s, this was frontier stuff to try to, you know, show representation. Although Kirk, you know, really smiling at the assistants in their mini skirts, a little too close to the governor of New York, perhaps. Now, all one body really wants to flip the script in the CRC, and they don't take the frontal assault approach on these things because, whether they know explicitly or implicitly, and in fact, if you look at some of the recordings of some of their meetings, they know this full well. And also they know that they don't have enough votes in CRC Synod to actually pass it as such. You know, they've sort of adopted the burn the house down approach, where we're not going to try to bring Synod something for them to pass because we know it won't pass. We're just basically going to keep throwing test cases at them and dare the other side to discipline us. And of course, discipline requires a lot, and it would be a terribly difficult thing. And so in some ways, that process sort of basically relies on a degree of apathy. And, well, I don't want to do this, so just let it go, and we'll allow the moral option. But of course, the conservatives who are paying attention say, yeah, we give in on sort of the merciful accommodation thing, and before long you're going to be hitting us with the equality justice thing, and then suddenly all of this stuff that we see going on in the culture, it's all going to be in the church, and you're going to be denouncing so-and-so because they voted the wrong way at Synod 2024, and, you know, we've got the internet, we know how this game goes. So you keep the books around, but sort of let the far bigger cultural guns continue to do the thing. And so the idea is basically that, well, sort of like racism, wait for the old people to die out and convince the young. And they've got, in many ways, really good reasons to do so. And, you know, one way or another, the inevitability of our position is on our side. And so we can afford to be patient, sort of stay around at the edges, keep pushing and pushing, and then try, you know, this, you know, dare them to discipline us strategy. And the difficulty is that now, years after the Women in Church Office fight, there might be the votes to discipline. And that then puts the Christian Reformed Church in a place that nobody quite knows where it'll go. Or they're looking at the RCA, where basically maybe they don't have the votes to discipline, but if you have 40, 50, 60% of your denomination sort of walking away, well, it's sort of a Pyrrhic victory then. So you tell contextual stories and, you know, you put out videos. Now, the argument is sort of, well, it's gotten better. Because in many places in the public sphere, a statement like the, we don't believe that God accepts same-sex intimate sexuality. In many places in the public sphere, a statement such as this would be jeered and even deplatformed as blatant bigotry. Even Donald Trump, who, of course, there's no love lost for Donald Trump, they tried to tag homophobe on him, but, you know, they might have the video of him on the Inside Edition bus. I don't remember what Yellow Journalist TV show that was, but he didn't really care to go after this so much. You know, he pretty much went after what was politically expedient. And you don't really find Republicans. There's no big. It's not like Roe versus Wade, where there's this generations long fight to take over the courts for this. You don't hear the same things going, although you hear plenty of fear on the other side about it. And for this reason, churches are sort of in a pickle. And there's really only two strategies that churches can take. Churches kind of have two options in two-speed Protestant America, because remember, in some ways, in Protestantism, the church sort of replaces the monastery as the high speed, and those outside the church in the state sort of are the second speed. And so really, the two options are be the moral vanguard blazing the trail for the culture to follow in the future, or be the zealous rebels who defiantly resist the empire, bravely holding out even for a lost cause. Now, people aren't going to like who they are in this in some ways, but the main line are supposed to be the trailblazers because, you know, they sort of act like it, but nobody's convinced they're blazing any trail and nobody's convinced they're the cutting edge of anything. They might feel like they're the cutting edge of the church, but, you know, it's like being the cutting edge of harmonica music. Until harmonicas make their way back, you can be the cutting edge of harmonica music. Apologies to all the harmonica players out there that feel themselves to be culturally dispossessed. Progressives don't see their space as vital. I mean, progressives outside the church don't see the inside the church space as vital anymore. The cutting edge is on law and art and culture. Progress is measured in law and money. The big guns are in the arts, music, film, TV, politics. And, you know, it's not unusual. There was a Christian Reformed minister who was on the progressive wing of the church. He gave up his ordination in the church and, you know, ran for office in the state of Michigan. That's an absolutely understandable thing for someone to do, because for him, it's like, if he wants to be on the vanguard, get into politics. Don't be in the church. Church isn't vanguard of anything. And so the main line isn't despised. They're just sort of a nice, anachronistic oddity, like harmonica players. Again, my apology to all the harmonica players out there. And the other problem is that the plucky rebels look like the man. and we're going to get into exactly why. Bunker churches holding out, waiting for the rapture or the eschaton, or trying to hold true to their little groups until, you know, you'll have to unpeel my dead, dying hands off my position and I'll be rewarded in the afterlife. They're the plucky rebels, but none of us look at any of this way. And again, back to Peugeot's parasitic storytelling. As a culture, we cheer the rebels against the empire. Why aren't we cheering the religious conservatives as a culture? Well, again, Protestantism, the state is the second speed. The progressives cast themselves as the plucky rebels, and they must do so. And this, again, triggers this whole, is Christianity revolutionary? And kind of the debate between Peugeot and some of our Mennonite and Christian anarchist friends here. Now, the man is always in context. And on CRC Voices, someone pointed me to an article in the Dort University student newspaper where a Dort student is suing the Iowa Department of Education, trying to get the religious exemption removed for her college. She identifies as queer and felt that the environment was unsafe or hostile or toxic or whichever word you'd like to use. The progressive vanguard has been able to cast themselves as the plucky upstarts who possess the clear moral vision of the future against the vast corrupt ways of the past that are denied protective class fit citizens their due. Queer students at Dort are harmed by the college's conservative posture. Pay no attention to the fact that the vast majority of universities in the country, often at considerable financial savings, will not only affirm but cheer her queerness. But if you want to be cheered, you're going to have to really work hard to find that cutting edge and occupy it, because otherwise you'll just be one of those other minorities that, you know, well, we've sort of gotten used to. And this is part of the trick here, is that you always have to sort of seek out the unconquered fields. Dort represents, in this little scenario, in this context, the man, and must be brought to heel. It's just getting harder and harder to find the man to oppose him. And, you know, again, this very interesting video on this one channel, Ready to Harvest, where he takes basically these six cities and checks out, and he selected the cities not by the churches that are in them, but by demographic and population and all these different filters. And it's a really interesting video because he basically shows which churches have churches almost everywhere, sort of like McDonald's. And you know what? When it comes to Presbyterian and Reformed, it's the PCUSA. And so almost anywhere in America, if you want to go to a Reformed or Presbyterian church, the PCUSA is available. But of course, for many people, it's no, this is my family and my church. Why should I have to give up the cause of justice and equality just because these people won't evolve fast enough? That's the argument. Every resistance pocket must be brought to heel. But again, in this context, we're the plucky rebels looking for equality and justice. But this advantage creates some real difficulties. The difficulty, as Peugeot points out, however, is that no matter how much the progressives win, they must continue to portray themselves as the underdogs. Apple must continue to imagine, remember that 1984 commercial? Imagine it's the plucky rebel, the plucky rebel, long after it's got hundreds of billions of dollars in the bank and iPhone hegemony and commercial success. Apple is the revolution. Really? Oh, no, it's Google. Really? They're both at the top of the world. This means that the progressive wave, in order to continue to win victories, keeps propping up their feeble opponents in order to revisit that glorious rebel win. It's sort of like the Washington Generals playing the Harlem Globetrotters forever and ever. And to the Globetrotters, you've got to keep paying to keep the Washington Generals on the floor. But nobody's there to see the Generals. They're all there to see the Globetrotters do all of their stuff and win the game. To keep the dynamic going, there must be new fields of conquest. And this is why All One Body and other activist groups struggle to appeal to an ideal apart from the progress, they can't find another ideal. Apart from progress or equality, all means all. But then if you begin to sit down and say, but now wait a minute. If I say, well, why do you keep... Are you going to police sexuality in the church? Well, in the leadership, yeah. But can't we turn those things into identities? We've seen this trick a lot. If you're going to stop policing, you've got to stop policing the leadership. We can't do that because, well, then you have all the other things. So, like I said in the 3-hour video, I think there's an inherent structural problem to this. And so what I keep trying to do, what All One Body should do is, okay, show me your line. And show me your line that's convincing. This often requires the progressives to keep opening up new fields of conquest. This is why I don't think man for life or woman for life will matter 1 year after an imagined synodical victory. It almost doesn't matter now because young, bi, and queer often look at older lesbian and gays as bigoted for their born-that-way flag. You know, the trans and the bi and the queers are clearly the cutting edge today. And Andrew Sullivan is just an old fart who wants to say thus far and no more. And conservatives in the CRC can hardly be blamed for noticing this. They have the internet and they watch and they're like, you're not fooling me. Now, I know I'm an equal opportunity offender in this because I'm not as clear as conservatives would like me to be on one hand, and I'm not as affirming as progressives would like me to be on the other. But could I be wrong about all of this? And could I be wrong about my posture that I'd like to at least see the progressives do better at what they're doing? Yeah. And I, as I've said many times on my channel, my position on this is we're probably not going to have clarity in the church over this for centuries. And again, I look to Alistair McGrath's fine little book, Heresy, and apply sort of a Jordan Peterson Darwinian posture in terms of figuring out the truth. Because it could be that the progressives win all the cultural battles, but disappear, and it's only the stubborn traditionalists that actually endure over time. Well, why is that? Is that because they're right? Is that because of other dynamics, such as you actually need a group to have a countercultural posture, and you don't need a group if you don't have a countercultural posture? Who needs the mainline church if you've got the Democratic Party? Unlike the Republican Party, we don't even care if they pray. So you're hard-pressed to find an Old Testament passage that anticipates laying aside circumcision. I'm preaching about circumcision in my sermons right now. And, you know, it's easy to read Paul's argument, and it feels radical. And I know some of my Jewish audience are saying, yeah, Jacob, I'm thinking about you, are saying, yeah, Vander Clay, come on, you're named after that guy. And the Judaizers are very concerned. Where is the line going to be drawn? You know, after you give up circumcision, pretty soon you'll be, I don't know, eating food with blood in it. So these are big issues. Might this be the case with this? Yes, it might be. It might be that 300 years from now, or 100 years from now even, people in very conservative churches don't care about this at all. Maybe the progressives are right. Could be. But again, you got to get by your binary shibboleth filter to get there. So wait a few hundred years. But that doesn't really work because many of us are asked to make decisions or at least have positions on this today. And our binary shibboleth filter is going off. And so basically we're laying bets today on things that might be settled centuries after we die. That's the nature of conflicts like these. So whichever side you're on, I would argue, don't waste the conflict. And in order to not waste the conflict, you're going to have to figure out how to not be too triggered by the conflict. And I think to actually do what we should, even in terms of trying to get to better levels of clarity, to resist the triggering impact is sort of table stakes of getting at these issues. The underlying dynamics have applications beyond the filter. And we're in it now, and we can't seem to stop it, so don't waste it. Those are my thoughts. Let me know what you think. Leave a comment.